Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Hey, if you guys like to cook outdoors, and you oughta, you should check out the Weber Slate Rust Resistant Griddle. So this is a carbon steel cooktop that's safe for metal tools. It's pre-seasoned with food-safe oils and ready to cook on right out of the box. It's the griddle that stays ready, not rusty. This griddle heats evenly edge to edge, reaching all the way up to 500 degrees. Get fired up for your new Weber Slate rust-resistant griddle. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Hunting Collective. I am Ben O'Brien, and this week I am in the offices of the Meat Eater here in Bozeman, Montana, and I am joined by the great and powerful Mark Kenyon of Wired to Hunt. Now, you're going to know Mark as a personality in our little Meat Eater family, but you're also going to know him from all of his wonderful Wired to Hunt media products. He's a whitetail dude, you know, self-described whitetail guy. And I like him for that, because I grew up as a whitetail guy, really, on the eastern East Coast, over there in Maryland. And I can relate to a lot of things that he loves to do. I love to do them, too. And so it's a great conversation around our Meat Eater Christmas party, but it broke into some more serious conversation around the imperfections of bow hunting, around some of the imperfections around finding deer once you've hit them, and then should you tag a deer or not if you wounded it. Bunch of heavy topics, bunch of laughs, bunch of fun stuff. That's Mark Kenyon for right now. Hey, Mark Kenyon.
Hey, Ben O'Brien.
We're just talking about the amount of podcasts. Like, how many podcasts do you feel like you've done, both you've been involved in, but then also hosted? It's got to be a lot of them.
A whole lot. 260 or so of Wired Hunt, 65 or so of another series I did.
Yeah,
been guest on a lot.
You were like the pioneer of one of the pioneers of podcasts. You had to be
one of the pioneers. Yeah, there's a few others before me, but definitely. I mean, I launched the Wired Hunt podcast back in the spring of 2014.
Wow. Okay. Who was around then? Was there any other podcasts around then? Because I certainly wouldn't listen to podcasts in 2014.
You know, the first hunting podcast I ever listened to was called Bowcast, I think. And I listened to that way back in 2009. I don't think that podcast lasted. I think it was around for a little bit, and then it was off the radar by the time I started podcasting. Yeah. But I listened to that one. Peterson's Bow Hunting had a podcast way back in 2009 for a little bit, too, that I listened to. But then that kind of faded away.
Yeah.
So there's a couple that started early, and maybe it was almost a situation where it was a little bit too early for critical mass.
Yeah, that might have been it, because I think Christian Berg had one.
That was the Peterson's bow hunting one. Yep.
Yeah, way back when I was at Peterson's.
Yep.
And he was the only person I knew that had a podcast, and I thought that's kind of a weird underground radio show.
Yeah, I mean it's a great medium, and I kind of got lucky in that when I dove into it was kind of a perfect meeting of the right time and the right kind of content.
Yeah, just something everybody should know is that we're coming off the Meat Eater Christmas party. So if we sound a little sluggish to begin, you know that we
I mean, there's a little bit of booze there.
There's a little bit of booze. So I got a full cup of coffee in front of me that I haven't got to dive into yet. So.
Yeah. Feel free just to, I mean, people enjoy. I don't drink coffee, so I'm drinking hot chocolate.
That was really interesting to me when you told me a few minutes ago that you've never even tasted a sip of coffee.
Not that I can remember. Now, I don't know, you know, saying it on a recording like that, I don't know. Maybe one time I did, but I don't remember ever doing it. I've certainly never took an intentional drink of coffee.
Yeah. Are you susceptible to peer pressure?
No.
So if I were to tell your podcast audience that we needed to all comment and message you and tweet you enough, if there was a landslide of protest that Ben needed to try coffee, would you give in for your listeners, for your beloved listeners?
For my people? I probably, yeah. I mean, like I said, I'm not a staunch, you know, anti-coffee person.
You're pro-nuance.
Yeah, I'm a pro-nuance, anti-bullshit. Yes, I think that I would probably try it. And then I would probably just, you know, just like, listen, people, it tastes terrible.
You probably wouldn't like it at
no,
first.
It doesn't taste good. It's not a. It tastes like a sock. I heard.
You know, that's not a bad way to describe it.
Yeah,
but socks are an acquired taste.
Yeah, and listen, it's got drugs built into it that get you all addicted, and next thing you know, I'm not against it. I have very many friends and colleagues and family members who think I'm foolish for not doing it, but.
Hey, more power to you. If you don't need to give in to the caffeine drug and you can still be productive and effective and a happy dude, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm doing all right.
Like, yeah, seems like it.
I'm tired a lot. Like I probably could use a little energy. Like if I drank a 5-hour energy, I would die. Like if I just drank a full one of those things, like chugged one. I had a boss one time who would drink like 3 or 4 of those things in a day.
Yikes.
Which really covers all the day, but 4 hours if you drink 4 of them. And she would, like 3 during a work day, have 3 of those things. And I did try a sip of that one time, and I almost had to go home. I was like,
yeah, that sounds dangerous.
Yeah.
Drinking that many.
And so that was part of it. Like, yeah. But I still, you know, now we're getting really deep into my, like, what's going down in my life.
Which is all we want to know.
That's all it is. I eat a lot of sugar, so I'm not, I got no... We had Giannis Patelis' wife made this, like, they call them adult cookies. I don't know why. Not because
they're calling them?
Yeah, because I think it takes so long to make them that they don't want to have the children eat them because they won't appreciate it.
I would have thought it was something else.
That's what I was thinking. I'm like, let's go. Yeah. Let's get it done.
I'm all
for these adult cookies. I've had some in Colorado.
Yeah, exactly.
But
I wonder why you're lingering in that corner all night last night.
You wonder why I was a bit the chip
He's
area.
Pouring in the cookies.
I must have eaten like 11 of these cookies. That can't be. I mean, that's not good for you.
Probably not great.
But Ali, I don't drink a whole ton. I don't smoke. I don't dip. I don't drink coffee. But boy, like, I'll rock a cake, man. Like half a cake. I don't even care.
We've all got our thing.
So listen, I'm not without, like, I can't make fun of the coffee drinkers for having a vice. Like, because most people drink coffee like, I can't get my morning started without a coffee, man.
And that's how you are with chocolate cake.
Yeah, like I'll have a...
I need my chocolate cake.
Well, you saw my truck this morning. It's full of, you know, cake wrappers.
And Perrier.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. Like a nice sparkling water. Yeah.
Did I say that right?
Yeah. Well, no, those were Pellegrinos.
Oh, Pellegrinos. Yeah. Okay.
Like giant bottles.
They're huge. I thought you had giant bottles of opened wine bottles in your car. Like, wow.
Sparkling white wine.
This guy's serious about his wine.
It's Christmas season. No, I do like I do like a nice sparkling water.
That's good.
I required that taste when I worked at Yeti, and they had free LaCroix.
Mm. That's a big thing. That's one thing I never got into, but I know a lot of people like it.
But then it's like, yeah, it's nice.
This is the plan for the whole podcast, right? Is just talking
talk
about our beverages?
About, yeah, beverages, consumption habits. Good. Yes, that's... Actually, I have a special announcement. That's we're changing the subject matter. Hunting is getting a little bit old. We feel like we've done it all, and we're just gonna
diversify
caffeine and caffeine related beverages.
I'd listen,
but yeah, the Meat Eater Christmas party. Did you have a good time?
I had a very good time. Yeah,
it was fantastic.
It's cool. Like I was telling you a little earlier, it's just cool to see this whole group of people that. To this point, has largely been scattered all across the country. Mm. Everyone kind of doing their own thing. It was just an idea 6 months ago in a lot of ways. And now all of a sudden we're here with a whole group of people all together working towards a common cause and seeing that physically manifested.
Yeah.
That was exciting.
Yeah, we've talked about it before, I know, like, but companies are these imperfect, you know, entities mm-hmm. that have all these imperfections, and a lot of times we focus on those imperfections because we're trying to fix them, right? Mm-hmm. And that's for good reason. But it's nights like last night where you're in a room of people, everybody's having fun, everybody's having a drink, and everybody's eating good food. We had like fresh oysters and Dungeness crabs and sika deer ham and all kinds of stuff. And it's fantastic. And you kind of forget about those imperfections for a while because you don't have to, like, there's no problems to solve anymore. Yeah. Not that, you know, it's not a bad thing. It's just how it is.
But it's needed, though.
It's good. Yeah, it's needed. Every once in a while, you need to just kind of like sit back and the holiday seasons are good for that. But like, take stock and like, what's really going on here. And we could overstate it for marketing purposes, but it's a pretty cool thing to be a part of, I would say.
I would say so too.
Yeah, I don't know if I have any. No, there wasn't anybody who was like that guy at the Christmas party. I left pretty early.
Yeah.
But nobody.
I didn't see anyone who's going to be getting like a terse email this morning or anything.
Like, dear sir.
Yeah.
none of that. That's
appropriate
good.
Behavior in the subject.
That's good. Yeah. No, we had a white Christmas gift party.
I think it's called a white elephant.
Was that what it is? White, what'd I say? White Christmas.
It's not a white Christmas.
It's early.
It's like a white elephant is the deal.
White elephant Christmas. Yeah, white elephant, whereas you get a gift and then you steal other people's gifts.
Swap them, steal them, all that.
It's very, very ruthless.
You got kind of screwed over a couple
times. Yeah.
You were a frequent victim.
Yeah, we had a deal like at the very start of the party, before the booze started flowing. We had a deal where you would shoot there was a squirrel target on the back fence at our CEO's house. And if you could hit it with a .22, you got a squirrel. And that squirrel gave you like special powers.
Yes.
At the white Christmas elephant gift exchange.
Yes.
That we held. And like, I had a squirrel because I hit the thing with the .22, and I was very confused about how to use the squirrel, but it gave you like a power to like steal at any time or whatever. I ended up with a sweet like a lever action Nerf gun. And had a sheriff's badge with it.
I was going to say, the sheriff's badge, I feel like, was the part that you liked the most.
And I stole this from a coworker, and I put on the sheriff's, like,
proudly.
And I thought, well, I've got this. And, like, I've got the squirrel. Nobody can take this from me. I'm going to go ahead and, like, unpack the gift and put on the sheriff's badge. Like,
Yes.
Yeah, I think everybody noticed that I was.
I certainly did.
And there apparently was... An axis of evil, like three people in the corner that were conspiring to take the person's gift who seemed the most excited about what they had.
Annie was very, very excited about ruining your night.
We need to call her out. Annie Razor is our VP of production. She's really the magician behind Meat Eater TV and all these fancy commercials you're seeing. But she, at this moment, and Josh Prestine as well, and Brody Henderson, I think. I can't remember the three. But they conspired to take away my joy.
Yeah, when they walked over and pulled that sheriff's badge off you, you could see it in your eyes.
Could you see, like, crestfallen? That's what I was.
Several of us noticed it. Like, did you see Ben's face?
That little sparkle.
Do you see that? Just a little bit of his soul died.
Yeah, that little sparkle just disappeared, and I'll never get it back.
Probably won't. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, but I ended up with M&Ms. I ended up with like a yard long M&M situation.
Good for the sugar guy.
Yeah, that was good for me. I'm like, maybe that's probably better. Because I would definitely shoot everyone around the office.
You laid in bed underneath the covers last night, slowly weeping and eating a yard worth of M&Ms.
So many M&Ms. But yes, I mean, those things devolve into like, you know, fun times.
Yes.
Fun times, but they did steal my joy. So I'd like to call those people out for their...
I think it's good.
And they told me later, they came over and they said, we definitely conspired against you, only because I seem to have the most joy.
Man, some people in this world...
The world is a tough place, Mark Kenyon.
I've noticed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is why we need podcasts like this.
Yeah, to talk it through.
Yes.
Otherwise, I wouldn't... You know, that feels pretty cathartic. I feel a little better about my life.
Good. That's all this podcast ever was for, right? Just to stroke your ego and make you feel better about things.
That's all it is. I said that at the beginning. I'm like, this is for me. I'm sorry about if you don't like me talking about the Christmas party.
Yeah, that's all I've ever done. That's all I've ever done, wired on too.
Yeah, that's all Christmas. But yeah, you're the vet. I mean, there's no way to pivot from the Christmas party to deer hunting, so we might as well just...
Yeah, I want to... How do you make that transition?
Just do it. I don't know. I'm not sure. But I, like, you know, I would say... I said this when I had Ryan Callahan on the podcast, that I felt like a good segment might be, like, the shit that's bothering me.
The shit that's bothering you.
Right. Not to say we don't have segments here on this program, but we do have things that I like to talk about pretty much every episode to annoy folks, but also...
So can we call that a segment? Shit I like to talk about on pretty much every episode.
Pretty much every episode, yeah. Sponsored by
Mark Kenyon.
Sponsored by
I come in for that.
Sponsored by Black Rifle Coffee.
There you go.
Which is looks like it's a nice company.
I haven't tried stuff
there.
Yet.
We have like a big pile of it over here in the office.
I'd like to try some.
I have a lot of nice people work there. I just don't, you know, have never had their product.
Did they pay you for this promotion?
Yeah, they did. Cha-ching. There's some things in the whitetail world that bother me. Now, okay. For point of fact, I grew up a whitetail hunter. I mm-hmm. once wrote a whitetail column for Peterson's Hunting Magazine and a whitetail blog for NRA's American Hunter. So coming up in the industry and growing up, I think at some level I was like, I'm going to be a whitetail guy, you know, like a whitetail expert guy, or at least somebody that wrote a lot about whitetails.
And you realized early on that was a path for despots and the low IQ types like me.
Yeah, it's a path for the cavemen like you.
Yes, yes.
No, I hunted other things. I could hunt everything. But I still think whitetails, man, I would say that the best thing in the world is sitting in a tree and like knowing every corner of an area where you're set a stand, and then finally hearing that like
ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch,
and it's not a squirrel this time
because 19 times because before 19 it was.
Times before it was
son of a bitch.
And I have to try to explain it to my wife a bunch of times around, like, I can tell you what a squirrel sounds like and what a deer sounds like, yep. And a raccoon, and I can tell you what an armadillo sounds like from mm-hmm. living in Texas, but there's I still feel like I've heard elk bugle. I've hunted, you know, I go through all the things I've hunted. I've heard moose doing their thing. But man, that like is the pinnacle, I believe.
And it's the pinnacle in a very different way from those other experiences you mentioned. Because those other experiences, like an elk bugling or seeing a goat on a mountaintop, those things are quite intense.
Yeah.
While the moments as a whitetail hunter are what they are because of the lack of intensity for so much of the time. It's long stretches of monotony where hopefully you can fall into an almost zen state where you're just taking in the world around you, and yes. It's this opportunity to kind of, yeah, I'd do that every time in the tree stand, literally make that noise. Maybe that's why I'm not seeing
you're not
deer.
Seeing any deer. You're doing it too loud. Yeah. They can hear the vibrations.
But you do kind of slip into like the stream of consciousness of the woods when you sit there long enough and it quiets down. You're just kind of part of it. And then though that is occasionally punctuated by these moments of like, this adrenaline burst of something happening. And it's those contrasts that make it really exciting. And in a very different way than an elk hunt is exciting. They're both really great in their own way.
Yeah.
But whitetail hunting is...
I just grew up spending so much time in you know, like tall timber country that that's just the, you know, that feeling, you know, East Coast, big tall oaks and, you know, like pretty, you know, where we were was mountainous country. And so I just being in that setting, watching leaves falling out of the tree, the heightened sense of awareness of, you know, animals move, birds, when the birds first start, you know, they're usually the first to sound off. But also things like when a squirrel's chattering at you and you're like, okay, well, that's a announcement to mm-hmm. everything else around what I've been up to. So, yeah, I mean, I think there is – I have an appreciation of that because it, like, signifies everything that – like the foundational elements of my hunting life.
Yeah.
You know, it signifies all these, like – none of this other stuff would have happened if it wasn't for
began there
before that. And so I'm living here though. I mean, living in Montana, there's some whitetails around, but I'll never get the feeling of like being in a tree stand and a large set of timber, you know, leaves falling around me with, you know, listening for that.
And it's actually more.
Yeah. And the squirrel's like.
Yeah. There's a certain cadence with you've got the front step or the front leg and the back leg coming up, and there's like bum, bum. Boom, boom, boom. Yeah, that's the rhythm. That if you hear that, you realize it's a deer.
That's
slowly
a deer coming.
Along.
Yeah, yeah, and that's and you know, it. There's a lot of stuff that comes to mind, but that ends up for me being. It's the pinnacle. It really just for me. It God, when I think about it, I think like let's rewind the calendar a couple months so I can go do it right now. Yeah.
So I worry though because you preluded all this by saying that we are entering the shit that bothers Ben segment, and so I feel like you're really setting me up like, oh, this stuff's so good, but
no, I think that I got a lot of shit that bothers me. I mean, I'm from the East Coast and I'm Irish. Like this is pretty much this is all we have to do. Yeah, this is all we have.
Speaking of Christmas parties,
yeah, I mean, drink. And be bothered by things is just about all that we do.
I'd love to be one of those family reunions. I feel like,
yeah, it's just, I mean, it's, I got this is what grinds my gears. Like, shit grinds my gears.
So sorry, I didn't mean to derail you.
No, I did. I was kind of setting you up a little bit there. Like, it's one of those compliment sandwiches. We'll end with another compliment as well. I say all this to say, like, part of my, the selfish nature of this podcast is because there are some things loving deer hunting so much and having worked around at some point in my career the North American Whitetail crew, getting to know those folks and working on their website a little bit and getting to know Bill Winky over the years, getting to know John Dudley over the years, getting to know some of the best, you know, Lee and Tiffany, getting to know some of the best that do it and seeing the way they express their deer hunting and seeing some of the changes really in the deer hunting culture that you have driven, a lot of which you have driven. There's still some things that like, there's still some whys that I think are worth talking about.
Let's do it.
Okay. The first of them is around how long do you leave a deer lay? I think in the prevailing, I came up watching like the Hunter Specialties DVDs and Realtree Monster Bucks. I came up doing that. And I feel as though there are some things in the culture like were seated there and just remained just because that was the media that was available at the time. And then that kind of got seated into outdoor TV and just became like part of the thing that you do, right? You shoot a deer and you leave it lay. Now, these are very general statements, but in general, I feel like no matter if it's a big mature buck or it's I'm just shot a doe or whatever the case is, I'm still thinking meat first. Mm-hmm. You know, once I've got a hole in the deer that I was targeting or wanting to kill, and so I'm still thinking meat first. So it comes down to for me, like I've shot a deer, I either have an idea where the hit is. You know, we're talking archery here probably, but rifle as well. Rifle less so, but I have an idea where the hit is. I feel like it was a good shot. A lot of folks don't film, you know, don't have film of every deer they've shot. So if you can't go back and look at the videotape, a lot of times, like, you know, your mind is moving so fast and you're, you know, a lot of this is reflex and instinct and in archery in these close quarter situations. You think you hit him well, you're not sure. The blood, you know, another point of this is like how to read blood and how to understand how to track an animal. That guys culturally are pushed to leave a deer lay overnight or for 8 hours, or would you agree that the prevailing thought is the longer you leave it lay, the better the chance of recovering the deer?
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at OReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's OReillyAuto.com/meateater. Pay attention here because this is a hell of a good service. It's called the Wellness Company. Picture this, okay? You wake up, you got a scratchy throat, you're all congested, you got a runny nose, you got a cough, whatever. And you weigh your options, like you tough it out, get sick, take time off work, try to get a doctor's appointment sometime in the next few months, wait 2 hours at urgent care and sit in a room full of six sick folks, or you open your medical emergency kit. You match your symptoms to the doctor recommended prescription, and you start on the right meds right away. These medical emergency kits, not a first aid kit, all right? It comes with doctor-prescribed meds to treat over 39 medical issues. So, on hand, strong antibiotics for infections of all types. Plus, a doctor's easy guide so you know exactly what to take and when. No waiting to see the doctor, no waiting at the pharmacy. It's all in there. Every home should have at least one medical emergency kit. Order yours online in minutes. Your kit will be rushed to your door. Get 15% off at twc.health/meateater, but you got to use the promo code meateater. That's promo code meateater, okay, at twc.health/meateater. Hey, everybody knows Weber grills. I've been using Weber grills my whole life, and check it out. They got a pellet grill, the Weber Searwood pellet grill. Now, with a pellet grill, you can smoke, roast, and sear, what I like to do, on the same grill. You can go from low and slow, okay, on smoke boost mode, which gives you great smoke at 180 degrees, or crank this thing all the way to a heat sear at 600 degrees. It's got a full great sear zone, so you can put more food on the flame. This is my way of bowl staying. If I was going to cook roast one way, that's how I like to do it, sear roast. Utilize the smoke boost setting to intensify that smoky flavor. Direct flame cooking creates searing, crisping, and browning. Food's going to look as good as it tastes. This grill gets hot in 15 minutes. Cleanup is easy. Cook confidently with intuitive digital controls at the grill and enjoy the sleek, easy-to-use surface. You can also add a heavy-duty rotisserie or rust-resistant griddle insert to up your game. Get fired up for your new Weber Searwood pellet grill.
I would say not entirely, but there are certainly situations where a common belief is better safe than sorry.
Yep.
A lot of times. And I think sometimes that's warranted, sometimes not.
Yep.
Yeah. And I can expand on that if you want.
Please.
So I get what you're saying. Your issue is that too many people are letting these deer lay because they just want to make sure they get that buck or whatever, not taking into account the fact that they're letting something lay for 8 hours and it's hot out, and when they get that, the meat's soured, and they don't recover that meat.
Yeah, and or coyotes come into play coyotes as well.
Yep, yep. So that is certainly a risk in waiting to track a deer.
Yep.
In certain situations. I would argue that there are some situations where if you feel very confident with where you saw that shot placement, if you saw, you were able to check the shot site of impact and saw this type of blood at the site, there's certain indicators that will tell you, you know, this is a dead deer. Like this is a deer that was hit double lunged. We got great lung blood.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of thing where there's simply no need to wait that long. Wait an hour, 2 hours max, something
yep.
like that.
Yep.
Your meat's not going to go bad in that shorter time frame,
no.
assuming it's not
no.
120 degrees or something.
Yeah.
In that kind of situation, give it just a little bit of time, because there are situations where like a single long hit deer that might look like a great shot. If the angle's a little bit off and you just get one long, that deer can go a little bit longer than you'd want it to.
Yeah.
So the situations where, you know, I would never say go out there 5 minutes later, go bouncing right back.
Yeah, nor would I. I mean, I think you have to understand a lot of things, right? You have to understand how far can deer go with a double elk hit, right? In, generally 100 yards is what...
I would say if I had to ballpark it most of the time, yeah. So I think this comes down to, though, that takes a level of understanding of where you saw that arrow or bullet hit, what the sign looks like, what the situation was, and knowing what the right next step is based off of that. And I think there might be a lot of people who see people on TV, I'm going to let it lay. You see that a ton on TV. Going to wait overnight. And a lot of people, I think, maybe just start assuming, do that no matter what.
Yeah.
And so I would say in the situation I just outlined, where it's that kind of, hey, this buck is here within 100 yards, barring some kind of crazy, shocking surprise. In that kind of situation, it does not make sense to risk anything with that meat, especially if it's a warm day. You also need to take temperature into account.
Oh, yeah.
So if it's a hot day, I'm moving all my time frames up. Because, yes, there would be nothing more devastating to me than walking up on a deer that I killed and not being able to recover that meat.
Yeah.
Except.
Or having the hind end be gone.
Having the hind end gone. That is except the one alternative. There's one thing that is more devastating to me than that.
Yeah.
Which is knowing that I hit a deer and knowing that deer is probably going to die because of where that shot was, but not recovering it at all.
Yeah.
Which is why I still believe that there are some situations where it is right to wait.
Yes.
Because it is better to recover a deer that's missing a hind quarter or maybe a little bit of his soured. It's better to make that recovery. It's not ideal. It's not what you want. But it's better to get that recovery than no recovery at all.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're right. 100% right. I mean, and I don't... when I say this bothers me, I think it bothers me for the reasons you outlined around just depth of thought around these types of things. And does not fall back on some prevailing... idea that leaving it lay is the right thing to do because you're being cautious and you're trying to recover that deer in the first place. That's the goal. So you hit a deer, you need to recover it. And so, you know, having a bigger conversation around the balancing act that occurs there. And I think you said a lot of what I think about what you have to, as a deer hunter, have to understand, right? You have to understand shot placement, shot angle. You have to understand the effectiveness of different types of shots.
Mm-hmm.
You have to understand then, once you've determined that, then the next step is to determine, okay, what's the temperature, right? What's the variabilities here? What's the temperature? What are the levels of predation in this area?
Yep.
What direction did this deer run? Did he run downhill? Did he run uphill? Is there a dry creek bed here? Is there a ravine? Is there a thick spot where I know he might go?
Yep.
There's a ton of variables here. So... But I think understanding that, right? And so then you set that stage, paint that picture like, okay, I hit him hard. I know I hit him hard. I hit him in a good spot. Likely one long, but probably two. He ran downhill. He his front end was, looking wobbly as he went downhill. Probably a better way to say that, but that's what you're looking for.
Yeah, go get that buck.
Yeah, he ran downhill, right? Well, he ran uphill, stood for a while, and chased a doe off.
Then I'm thinking,
I don't know.
Yikes.
But it's pretty warm, and we've seen a lot of coyotes today, and he ran into a place where he's probably just going to stay, right? So I'm thinking, okay, now I don't want to leave him lay overnight in this scenario, but, man, I've seen on TV a lot of guys just leave him lay overnight. And I got to recover him. I'll get the antlers and maybe get the back straps, but at this stage, I'm sure I'm not going to get... I think I hit him good, but I'm sure I'm not going to get the meat at this point, or I'm not going to get all the meat. My philosophy there is it's like I'm going to find a way to determine where this deer's at. And then you have the other scenario where he runs close to a neighboring property, or he runs to a place where you're not... If you push him, you push him onto public land, or you push him into a place where he's going to get whacked. So I have for sure I've been in a lot of these situations. You surely have as well. So,
comes back to what you said, nuance. You gotta, and there's some folks that are just getting into this that just haven't had the opportunity to have those experiences and learn yet. And in that scenario, I would just caution people to not just see something on TV and say, oh, that's what I'm supposed to do. Try to dive into it. There's a lot of great resources out there that can walk you through what different colors of blood indicate as far as shot impact. There's different resources that you can look at that will talk you through, okay, if you see the arrow hit here, this is likely with the vitals that hit. This is likely how much time we would recommend you wait.
Well, didn't deer and deer hunting used to do like 3D renderings of a deer?
Yeah, they had an app.
Yeah, and that would show you exactly what vitals it probably went through. Yeah.
I don't know if that's still around, but it was a handy tool back in the day.
You also had different types of blood. You can look, there's plenty of resources around what that looks like. If it's bright red and it's got bubbles in it, that's pretty surely lung blood.
Yep.
The darker the blood, you have dark, like liver type blood. Then you have, if you're finding any bile or any types of chunks of green stuff, that's guts.
That's the kind of scenario. If you get a gut shot, paunch shot, that is the one scenario where you're probably not going to recover that deer unless you wait.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to get a good blood trail at all. But that deer, if you do let it lay down, and this is the imperfect part of deer hunting.
Yeah.
Right? And we talk about this sometimes, that there are some scenarios where things, even if you did everything you possibly could have done right, there are so many variables when it comes to any kind of hunting, whether it's deer hunting, elk hunting, caribou hunting. There are variables outside of our control sometimes. Sometimes the shot does not go just perfect, and you get a gut shot for whatever reason. Something like that happens. That, what happened then, is water under the bridge. Right? And tell me, this is what happened.
Yeah.
It is not what I want to happen. It is a bad situation, but that is what happened. So how do I make the very best out of this less than ideal scenario? And so in that case,
let me stop you there, because this is something that I've wrestled with, and I think I've come to this conclusion recently. Just over, there was a scenario last year or 2 years ago, I had, where somebody I was hunting with shot a deer, and we argued about. I said, "Go get that damn deer, man. We've seen 6 coyotes in this 5 days we've been hunting. It was a big giant buck. I mean, it was 175, 180 inch buck. The buck gets shot. I'm arguing it was like a one lung through the liver, quartering two angle shot. That wasn't the best shot in the world, right?
But not the worst shot.
Not either. The worst shot in the world. A lethal shot.
Yeah.
Because I filmed it. So we had film and we were able to watch it. Watched what the deer did. The deer ran down into a dry creek bed that kind of fingered off into two areas. And the guy I was hunting with, who owned the property, knew that this deer was likely going to get down in that and run that dry creek bed till it ended and be somewhere in there. Like, we kind of know where this deer went to lay. And he's like, "Well, we'll just leave it lay overnight." I'm like, "If you leave it lay overnight, you're losing the meat. Like, you're not getting it." It was cold enough for the meat to be, but those coyotes are going to find it. And we saw 3 coyotes within 100 yards of where this deer's going to end up. They're going to find it, and they're going to chew on it. And it's also, partly shot in the guts, shot in the vitals, but also in the guts. Mm-hmm. So you know that thing's going to be sour by the time you get to it. I was like, "I know it's going to die. I think it's going to die in 4 hours or 5 hours would be my guess." And they shot it about 11 a.m. I'm saying, let's wait till 3 or 4.
Yep.
Then you have a hunter that's like, it wasn't necessarily in this case, but some hunters like, "This is a 180 inch buck. I got to get those antlers." Like, I was like, "Well, I'd much rather have that deer run to Timbuktu and die over there and me never find him than me find him and not be able to eat the meat."
See, that's where I would disagree with you.
Yeah.
Because you don't know you won't be able to eat any of the meat if you wait. Now, I would argue that in that situation that you just outlined, where you think that buck's going to die in 3 to 4 hours or something like that, is like a very safe, then yeah, I'm all for it. I would go and get him then.
Yeah.
I would not let a buck lay overnight unless I absolutely thought that it was necessary.
Yeah, so the question becomes, how safe is safe?
Yeah, and that's a judgment call each person's got to make. But I there's nothing that would make me more sick. I'm very fortunate. I've not yet lost the meat from a deer, because that would just devastate me. I would feel, I personally cannot justify killing an animal unless I'm eating it.
Yep.
That's where I draw my line for myself. But at the same time, if I shoot a deer and I think it's a gut shot and I know, man, if I go in there right now, I'm bumping that deer and I'm never going to find it. Then you have, in my opinion, then you have to wait, because, like I said, it's better to recover some portion of that animal.
Oh yeah,
than to let it completely go to waste.
Yeah, nothing.
But it's a shitty situation to be in. You don't want to be in that situation. You're doing your best to make the right judgment call.
Yeah, right or wrong, right? I mean, you again, it comes back to the responsibility of a hunter. The last podcast I did with Dushan Smetana.
I saw him on the website. I'm not familiar with him otherwise, though.
He's just a wonderful human. But he grew up in Czechoslovakia, and they had this thing called, I'll butcher the pronunciation of it, but Miklavik in their culture means like hunter, but it also means thinker. It means, the way he describes that is like the hunter has to be well studied in the flora. Like they take classes before they can go hunting on the flora and the fauna and have to learn these things. And like the respect for the hunter comes from the depth of thought and knowledge of the outside world. And the way he describes that is like, that's your responsibility because you're selecting an animal. You have to know the animal because you're selecting it from the herd to be taken, and you're eating it. And then you have to be efficient to find it and kill it. And then once, you know, in this case, once you've killed it, recover it. So I always think about that. So at this, you know, there's like a, if this was, you know, teetering on how do you push forward and find the deer or do you let it lay? I don't think there's a clean answer. I think what bothers me is that some hunters think there's a clean answer there. That's like always leave it lay or fall back on leaving it lay. So that's what bothers me. There's a lot of hunters out there that do it the right way. I think most people will do their best job at it, but I think some of the cultural just relevance of leave it lay needs to be explored.
And I think it's a good point. And I do think that it probably stems from media where there's not an, I can't claim to know the thought process for the folks on TV saying this, but I would guess that a lot of people edit out a lot of the thought process and just say, oh, we're going to let it lay, be safe.
Yes.
And maybe there was some serious thought in there and trying to find what their right judgment was. And then the viewer just misses out on that. So then it's just like thinking, well, this is just what you do. You just always let it lay. Or maybe there is, maybe there are people who are knowingly saying, well, I don't really care about the meat and I just want to get those antlers. I hope that's not the case. I pray that's not the case, but you know, there might be some folks out there like that.
Yeah. And I'm sure, you know, it's hard. These conversations are hard because you don't want to generalize in any way, right? You just can't, it's not fair to people to generalize in any way. I'm sure there are people out there that are like, I'd rather like, I either get the meat or the deer runs off. I don't care. And there's people out there that say, I don't care about the meat very much. If I get some, great. If not, I'm not really worried about it. As long as I get those antlers, that's what I'm. That's what I'm here to do. So you know, I think these complex issues always goes back to like it'll be a be a thinker and make and you know be the Miklavik. And
I really like that.
Yeah, man. It
the hunter and thinker should be synonymous.
Yeah, and so these are things that require thought. Mm-hmm. And I think in the whitetail world, like there's so much media out there. There's so much noise out there about this big buck or that big buck or that experience. Like this is one of those things that just, it requires lots of knowledge. You know, you have it. I have some of it. Like I've tried to, you know, as a function of my hunting, learn these things, but it's worth reiterating that these aren't with, you can't really do it without these things.
Yeah. And I think there's nothing we do in our entire lives. I think that, and it's interesting because sometimes we grow up hunting and you just do it because it's what you do and just because it's what your dad or grandpa or whatever family member or friend did. And as a kid, it was fun and you just did it. And, you know, myself growing up, I didn't really put a whole lot of thought into it. I just knew I loved it.
Yeah.
But as an adult now and having had the opportunity to think on these things a little bit more, I don't think there's anything more deserving of thoughtfulness and critical thinking in our lives than hunting, because that's there's nothing more serious. There's nothing we are taking a life. Can you name one thing more serious than taking a life?
No.
So, without a doubt, that action should be something that serious thoughtfulness should be required.
Yeah. That's how I like that. Like the cultural significance of that, and that's again, we get real deep in this conversation, but it gets back into like what is a hunter traditionally in our society, in our culture. I mean, a hunter was a provider. A hunter was, you know, to be, you know, really at, you know, for lack of a better term, and this is a pun that I don't like, but like at the top of the food chain within a tribe or within a group of people, the hunter was seen. Was seen with great significance. And I think I find our culture to be a little bit loose when it comes to that. Deer hunting culture is the prevailing culture within the hunting world. More people go deer hunting than do anything else by far.
Yeah.
And there's more deer than any other, you know, game animal.
America's big game animal.
By far. So there's a lot of influence that goes into that.
Yes.
So that's one. That's one that I think spins into another thing that we've been talking about lately here in the office, and you and I have talked about some, is just the wound rates and, you know, the way you put it is like the imperfections of bow hunting, mm-hmm. right? And some of the difficulties around how we treat archery as a group, and then the results, and how open we are about the results.
Yeah.
For fear of I would imagine for fear of attack. Take me through, like, as somebody who hunts, you know, mainly with a bow, like your thought process is when you're talking about archery on your podcast, or when you're trying to, you know, get people into hunting and lead them into hunting and say, pick up a bow first, mm-hmm. you know, that's what you ought to do. Like, what are you thinking about that?
Well, I don't know if I would necessarily recommend that.
Yeah.
That probably wouldn't be what I would say. If there's someone new to hunting, that might not be my first option. I think rifle hunting or crossbow hunting, if that's your thing, is easier to perfect as far as the effectiveness of the being able to kill an animal.
Yeah.
Like that process is simply easier to become competent at, I guess, than shooting a vertical bow, shooting a compound bow or a traditional bow. So for someone getting started, that's probably a great way to start, because there's a whole heck of a lot of things you got to figure out when you're figuring out how to deer hunt.
Yeah.
It's nice to at least know that your methodology for take is going to be as relatively of a sure thing as you can possibly get it. Mm. So that being said, I'm right. It's clear then, by way of me saying that, that using a vertical compound bow is more difficult. It is more difficult to become competent. It's more difficult to be consistent. There's more room for error. There's more room for things to go bad, for imperfections.
Yep.
And this is where this weird like dichotomy comes into play, because on one hand, I would tell you that as a deer hunter, my number one goal is to make as quick and clean and ethical of a kill as I possibly can. If I'm going to take the life of an animal, I'm going to do so the best way I possibly can to limit any kind of suffering, to make sure I recover that animal. I mean, I would say that's first and foremost. Yeah. At the same time, though, it might seem very hypocritical then to tell you that I actively choose to use a compound bow for 90% of my hunting. How do I justify that?
Yeah.
And I don't know if I have a perfect answer to that, but I can tell you that there is an experience. And maybe this is inherently selfish. Maybe this is something that we as bow hunter, maybe I'm a flawed, selfish human because I love to bow hunt, or I like to engage in hunting in that way. But the experience I have as a bow hunter is a very different experience than I have as a gun hunter. And that experience, that way of engaging with an animal, with the habitat, the skill and time and effort and practice, the amount of work that has to go into that to be successful, makes it incredibly compelling, addicting, interesting, forces me to become a more well-rounded outdoorsman. But yes, it does open things up to the possibility of things not going right.
Yeah.
And so with that said, what I find is that I simply have a greater obligation. If you're choosing to be a bow hunter, you're choosing to engage with animals and wildlife and stuff in this way, you just have a greater obligation to work your tail off to do as much as you possibly can to become more perfect. You're never going to become perfect. A bow hunter can't be perfect. There will always be imperfections.
Nor is a rifle hunter.
Yes. So mistakes will happen sometimes. I mean, it is tough. There are a lot of things that can go wrong.
Yes.
Animals can move. So no one, even the very best archers out there, even like John Dudley or someone, stuff's going to go wrong sometimes for these guys or girls. So I think the obligation just becomes then for us as hunters, bow hunters, to do everything we possibly can to every day become more perfect, get closer and closer and closer to minimizing any kind of error. And hopefully because of how uniquely engaging bow hunting is. This is a hypothesis, I guess.
Yeah.
But because of how deep that interaction is, that I think is unique with bow hunting,
yeah.
I think you could just dive deeper. I'm not saying that you can't achieve some of these things as a rifle hunter, but if I were to generalize, I'm overgeneralizing here, but I think via bow hunting, it forces you to get deeper into this thing, deeper into how you interact with these animals, understand these animals, all those things. I hope and I think it fosters a different level of, or a deeper level of care and a desire to give back and to find ways to make sure that we just don't take from this resource, but we also give. And I think maybe, I hope maybe that is how bow hunting provides a net benefit.
Yeah. Let me just say that.
I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it does. And here's what happens. This is my estimation, and I've done it in my life. I will start by saying I feel like I've sometimes been peer pressured into bow hunting because it was like a trendy thing to do. We got a dog fight in the office. I've been peer pressured into bow hunting because that's the trendier thing to do, right? The cool kids seem to be doing it. And nobody actually...
Certainly no one's thinking that because they're looking at me bow hunting.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, yeah, people... No, we got to get into what that guy said.
I know.
The text that I sent you. Those are two things we'll end with. but I think when it comes to this relatively serious subject, I always fall back on hunting is a very personal endeavor. And in its nature, in its modern sense, right? Because we could go to the store and get meat, because there's other ways for us to take on the act of conservation, right? I could go help with the translocation, help pick up trash on public lands, and be doing just as much for conservation, air quotes, as I would if I would go out and buy a license and shoot a deer, right? So all the things that we use as reasoning, like what you were just doing there was a very like a noble attempt to talk around, hey, look, this shit is selfish. It is personal. But it's selfish and personal because the end result is this thing that enriches you to such an extent that it's appropriate at the end of the day. It fosters caring for animals and it fosters caring for the natural world. But at the end of the day, it's a very selfish and personal endeavor.
And I guess we do need to own that.
Yeah, just own that. If you start from that owning, then the rest of it just becomes simple, right? We talk about that with catch and release fly fishing. Like, just own that shit.
Yes.
Just own that. It's a very selfish endeavor. But, like,
this is my opportunity. I could side rail us right now, but
we're not going.
We're not going there.
We
could have.
Mark and I had one time, like, a 2-hour.
It was like 7 o'clock at night. We were trying to work, and then 2 hours later, we talk about catch and release.
Catch and release. We're not going to do that here, we promise you. But I think that bow hunting is selfish a lot of times. And it's like, I admit it. Like, it's a selfish thing. I enjoy the experience more with a bow in my hand than with a rifle.
Yeah.
Does that complicate the ethical endeavor? Fuck, yes, it does. Yeah. Boy, it does a lot. But I also just realized that I'm not out there just for meat. I'm not out there just for conservation. It's not at its core an altruistic thing that I'm doing. It is very much for me, but it's for me for a good reason, you know, because it enriches my life and it gives me something. And the byproducts of which, meat and conservation, dearly love. And I think those byproducts are some of the most important things that I've given to your fucking world around me, or whatever, however you say it.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. Pay attention here because this is a hell of a good service. It's called the Wellness Company. picture this, okay? You wake up, you got a scratchy throat, you're all congested, you got a runny nose, you got a cough, whatever. And you weigh your options, like you tough it out, get sick, take time off work, try to get a doctor's appointment sometime in the next few months, wait 2 hours at urgent care and sit in a room full of six sick folks. Or you open your medical emergency kit. You match your symptoms to the doctor recommended prescription and you start on the right meds right away. These medical emergency kits, not a first aid kit, all right? It comes with doctor prescribed meds to treat over 39 medical issues. So, on hand, strong antibiotics for infections of all types. Plus, a doctor's easy guide so you know exactly what to take and when. No waiting to see the doctor, no waiting at the pharmacy. It's all in there. Every home should have at least one medical emergency kit. Order yours online in minutes. Your kit will be rushed to your door. Get 15% off at twc.health/meateater, but you got to use the promo code meateater. That's promo code meateater, okay, at twc.health/meateater. Hey, everybody knows Weber Grills. I've been using Weber Grills my whole life, and check it out. They got a pellet grill, the Weber Searwood Pellet Grill. Now, with a pellet grill, you can smoke, roast, and sear, what I like to do, on the same grill. You can go from low and slow, okay, on smoke boost mode, which gives you great smoke at 180 degrees, or crank this thing all the way to a heat sear at 600 degrees. It's got a full great sear zone, so you can put more food on the flame. This is my way of bold saying. If I was going to cook roast one way, that's how I like to do it, sear roast. Utilize the smoke boost setting to intensify that smoky flavor. Direct flame cooking creates searing, crisping, and browning. Food is going to look as good as it tastes. This grill gets hot in 15 minutes. Cleanup is easy. Cook confidently with intuitive digital controls at the grill and enjoy the sleek, easy-to-use surface. You can also add a heavy-duty rotisserie or rust-resistant griddle insert to up your game. Get fired up for your new Weber Searwood pellet grill.
So, you know, addressing what you said, I just think my opinion would be, after all that, is that this is just like what you said. It's a very, sometimes a selfish endeavor. I think when a fella puts on an orange vest and picks up a bow and goes out, like I would have to like hear a really good reason for that.
Choosing to bow hunt during gun season when you could be with a gun.
Yes, and there's, you know, obviously we know that in wildlife management and biology, like there's a reason why you can bow hunt from September to January, mm-hmm. but only rifle hunt from, you know, November 1st to November 11th or whatever, you know, just making those numbers up, obviously. Yeah. But there's reasons for that, right? There's wildlife management reasons. And wildlife managers and state game agencies are taking in wound loss numbers as they look at how many deer can be killed mm-hmm. from a certain state or a certain unit. So we know that too as we go into it. A lot of people archery hunt, deer are doing just fine. And so
the system we have in place is working.
Yeah. So as selfish as this thing may be, it's a working system.
Yes.
And it's got a lot of good that goes into it. So I mean, I think the imperfections of bow hunting are clear and present, but not so damning that we should never do it.
Yeah. I think as long as we own it and as long as the only thing that does bother me is the guy or girl who has experienced the imperfections of bow hunting and doesn't try to do anything about it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just going to grab my bow for the season. Yeah, I wound a couple deer every year, but I got my buck.
Yeah.
Put it up at the end of the season, and then next year, September 30th, I grab the bow out. That, I feel, that shows a disregard for the serious nature of what we're doing and for life. And
yeah.
So I would caution, I would just want anyone.
Yeah. I would go back to Dushan and his Miklovic, but like in that area of the world, in much of Europe, bow hunting is thought to be unspeakable. Like I've hunted in Bulgaria, I've hunted in Germany. It's starting to change in Scandinavia too. I mean, bow hunting is catching on in some of these areas, but traditionally they believe we have a rifle. This is ethical. It's more ethical and more responsible to use a rifle. In some of these areas and countries in Europe, bow hunting is illegal for that reason, because we have a more powerful, a more lethal weapon. To choose not to use it is foolish. There's arguments against that, like for us, longer hunting seasons and things of that nature, that certainly we would argue for, but even that's very selfish. But at the same time, you go over to Germany and they do driven hunts and they shoot rifles at running animals, mm-hmm. as a tradition, as part of their tradition. So all of this is oxymoronic at some level, but there is, if you think about the reverence and the culture and the European tradition for hunting, there's more reverence, there's a little bit more thought, and they don't use bows. But so that's just another way to go about it. You know? So I think for us, we think hard about why we choose archery. You know, I'm friends with a lot of folks that only pick up a bow and say that outright. I only pick up a bow. I only hunt with a bow. Hashtag whatever. Hashtag bow hunting only. And use a bow to shoot geese, and use a bow to shoot turkeys, and use a bow to shoot all types of things. They could just as well have shot with a shotgun or a rifle.
And you have a problem with that? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, it'd be hard to explain.
See, I don't have a problem with that for the same reasons that I just said in general, because as you mentioned, it's personal and it's a different way of, it's a very different way of hunting. Right? The interaction, the experience you have with a rifle hunting a deer versus being forced to get that deer within 30 yards, it's a totally different thing.
And you could set it up ethically where you're like, I'm only going to take these shots, I'm only going to do
these
types of things.
But who in the world has ever done that?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So I think, do I have a problem with it? I don't think that's one of the things I would go after, right? Yeah. As a hunter. Like, well, if some other hunter said, like, oh, I just hunt with a bow, I'd be like, all right, well, you better be pretty good then.
Better be pretty good. But there's something.
Doesn't bother me.
Yeah, there's something, I think. Now, I understand your point of view and the other, but I do think there's also something admirable about self-limiting and increasing the level of challenge. Because it's not just the actual execution of the shot, but it's everything else that happens around that. Everything, you must be a whole lot more.
Yeah, yes.
Just being in the right position, being at the right time, understanding there's so much more that goes into getting within 30 yards of an animal than 200. And that's why bow hunting is so compelling to me.
Yeah. No, bow hunting is much more compelling than rifle hunting. I mean, it's not even close. And I do most of my hunting with a bow. And so I'm not... certainly not challenging that as much as I am just saying, hey, look, like we all know it, and let's just be more open about it, and let's look at wound loss rates, and let's look at these things and try to talk it through.
Yeah, own it and get better.
Yeah, for sure. And I think looking at these other examples in the world of where these things – how these things are being treated, is it provides some perspective. Mm-hmm. I haven't spent a ton of time in Europe hunting and around those cultures, but the time I have has given me a lot of like, okay, there's a different way to think about it. And here's a different way, you know, and Sweden and a lot of parts of Scandinavia, you have to take a competency test with your weapon before you have to shoot a running steel plate, shoot a running moose.
Wow.
To be able to get a license to go hunt.
Interesting.
It was much that way for Dushan. I keep going back to him, but much that way for him in Czechoslovakia growing up. And so there's probably some things we can implement around bow hunting to just ensure that as a group, you know, we're holding ourselves to a standard, because there should be a standard, right? Yeah. I mean, I
think so. The counterpoint to that would be, well, we are already struggling to recruit hunters. You want to put more barriers in the way of that?
I'm with you. I'm not like a barrier dude. I'm not like let the government figure that shit. I'm never that guy. I'm always like, less of that seems always good.
But hopefully we can self-regulate.
Yeah, that's why. Yeah, self-regulation. I would agree with that. I think that ends up being the best way to do it. Yeah. Nobody's arguing against hunter safety classes.
Yeah.
Nobody's like, that sucks.
And that's a great opportunity to incorporate more of this education. I think there's an opportunity to improve what we're doing there, probably.
Yeah.
It's a long time since I've done that, so I don't know exactly what they're doing today, but...
I never shot a bow during... I shot a shotgun, I remember, during mine, and a rifle.
We didn't shoot anything during ours.
Yeah.
It was all classroom.
And, well, when I grew... in my growing up, we didn't really hunt with archery tackle until I was, like, maybe 18, 16, 17, 18.
Yeah, you know? I think I was, like, 13 or 14.
Yeah, it was... 2 weeks out of the year, get a rifle out and, you know, poke holes in animals. Yeah. The various things.
For me, it was poke holes in trees for a while.
For a while. But also, you know, if and we'll look at this on themeateater.com and hopefully in some articles to come by you and others, but look at, is this really true? Is the wound loss rate on average for rifles, you know, and archery, where is that? Where is that level? Because there's a lot of overconfidence with firearms. There's a lot of hedging your bets.
I think we
may find that we're completely off base.
I've wondered about that because I do think shot selection with certain people with a firearm is much looser than much looser. So that and the number of hunters using that weapon significantly higher. So you've got a way higher number of hunters out there, and now again overgeneralizing, but a much higher number of hunters, a much higher percentage of those taking low quality shots probably.
Yeah.
The weapon itself might be more effective, but only when used
the properly,
right way.
Yeah.
And I'd be very interested to see too.
So would I, because I think
I don't know what the answer is, but
you know, curious. The imperfection of bow hunting being what they are, that doesn't mean picking up a rifle is a perfect thing right. to do.
I mean, it goes back to an example you brought up earlier, like shooting a moving animal. That's something that people do with firearms quite a lot.
They have deer drives in Iowa. I think it's still legal.
It's a big thing in Michigan.
Big thing in Michigan. It's a big thing down south.
Yeah, but I think it's a traditional use thing. It's something I know a lot of people do. I'm not going to sit here and tell anyone what to do, but I will just tell you that growing up for me, my grandfather, who was kind of the patriarch of our family and our hunting camp, and he set the laws. If you were to shoot at a moving animal, you were out.
Yeah.
You're out. We had an uncle of mine brought a friend up to our deer camp 1 year, and they saw a buck chasing a doe across the field with inside a deer camp. And that guy ran outside the camp, grabbed his rifle off the side of the cabin, started pow, 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 shooting at that buck. He was gone. That wasn't acceptable because in my grandfather's eyes, that is not, you can't guarantee you're not going to wound that animal.
Yeah. Talk about self-regulation.
Yeah.
I mean, that's.
So that was the world and the tradition I grew up in. So that's where my perspective comes from. But I understand that there's different views.
Yeah, there certainly is. And that's something we're here to explore, man. Like,
yeah.
I think that's the beautiful thing about what we got going with this company is that we're all willing to engage in these conversations and poke holes in our own assumptions. Like, I got some assumptions about what bothers me. And I know that some of it's wrong.
Yeah.
I'm a boy. Like, it can't be all right.
Right. Oh, yeah. No.
It can't be. But identifying these things, like, you know, you've been pretty forward and talking about writing a piece on this subject. And I think that's it's the beauty of what we're going to try to do is take these issues that we all have. We all know they're there. I think, I don't know if you would agree with this, but I think maybe our father's generation and then some parts of our generation, would have rather pushed it under the rug for fear of, you know, persecution than talk it through.
I think having those conversations is important.
Yeah.
It's always something I've thought so too. Like, we may not agree on everything, but I think it is a positive step to at least put it out there.
Yeah.
Talk about it.
Yeah.
Think through these things.
So this is something I know you'll write about soon, but talk about if you have a tag, right? Every state is different for how they dole out their tags and licenses and things of that nature. But let's just build a scenario where you've got one tag for a deer every year with a bow. Let's just use a bow as an example. The big buck that you were chasing comes by. Something happens and you plunk one into his hindquarters.
Mm-hmm.
Plunk an arrow into his hindquarters. He runs off. You're relatively positive that he's not deceased. You try and try and try. You try to make it happen. Even in this, you know, even we'll just make up in this hypothetical that you hunt around the area where he was last seen. There is blood, but not a lot. There is hair. You know that you put a arrow into an animal, and then he's likely not dead. Do you notch your tag or not?
Yeah. So, I've been in this situation myself. And it's almost twice. I had two situations kind of similar to this. And I had two different perspectives on it. One was like 6 years ago. One was this year. And I thought differently about it this year than I did 6 years ago. And it's, again, it's another one of these issues that it's there's a weird line somewhere in here, and it's hard to know where to draw that line, I think. But that first scenario, I hit a deer and saw where the arrow hit. And it was back and low, and my first gut was that, you know, that should be a dead deer, but we tracked and tracked and tracked, and I looked for him for 3 days, never found him, very little blood. I was devastated. It was this buck I'd been watching for 2 years, the biggest deer at that point I'd ever gotten a shot at. It was really didn't want to have it end that way.
Yeah.
So I was pretty devastated, drove home that night. I'm not hunting anymore. Got pulled over for speeding on the way home.
Yeah.
I was in a bad place for a week. But then after a week, I was like, you know what? You know, I'm hoping that buck's still out there. I thought we should have found him. If he was dead, we should have found him. The shot was low. Might have been just like low brisket. I eventually convinced myself that I should keep hunting. And I got a picture, and I'm like, I got a picture of him.
Oh, wow.
So he made it. I thought he'd made it. Got a picture of a buck that looked like him. So, all right, I'm going to keep hunting. And so this is 2 weeks after having that first shot and not being able to recover that buck. I'm hunting. I see this buck come walking in. I'm like, oh, my God, that's Jawbreaker. It was real fast, though, how it was happening. So I'd gotten this picture of him alive the night before, or I checked the camera, seen it alive. The next morning, I made a move to go into that buck's core area again to try to get him set up like a hanging hunt type of deal. Within like an hour of daylight or something, here that buck comes, big, tall, framed deer, and a guy shot him. I'm like, oh, my gosh, I just got this buck. It was amazing that it all came together. It had been like the lowest of lows and then the highest of highs now. Fast forward a few hours, and I recover the deer. I walk up on the deer, and I look at him like, oh, that's not him. This is a different buck. And was like, whoa, he looked a lot like him. He was like a slightly smaller version of that deer. But then I realized I'd killed a different buck. And then as the season progressed, I kept checking trail cameras and stuff because my buddy was still hunting there. And no pictures of the original buck. No pictures of the original buck. No pictures of the original buck. So maybe he didn't make it. Maybe it was this buck all along. That spring, I go shed hunting right there in the area where I shot this buck, not far from the original buck. Mm. And it was also close where I shot that other one.
Yeah.
I find the original buck dead. And so then I'm thinking, man, you had killed that deer. He holed up in this little bottom of a ditch, and you just missed him. I mean, we grid searched. I brought two different dogs in to try to find him. So either we just somehow, by some horrible stroke of fate, missed him, or it had been like a several-day thing.
Yeah, he circled came back. Circled back. Came back, yeah.
So that was really shitty. And that was that first example in my life as a bow hunter where that had happened and where it really made me like think about this whole topic of the imperfections of bow hunting.
Yeah.
And the when that happens, what do you do? How do you process that? What does that mean for you moving forward as a hunter? How do you do everything you possibly can to make sure something like that doesn't happen again, et cetera, et cetera. So that was that situation. That's how I dealt with that situation at that point. Now fast forward to this past season. I get a shot at a deer in Montana on a hunt, and the shot seemed pretty darn good from what I remember from the shot. Like, I had video, it was kind of zoomed out, but I was like, dang, that's a pretty good shot. Like, that's a dead deer. There's no way that deer is not going to die. But I couldn't find blood. Now, that part of it's because I've got some red-green color blindness, so it doesn't pop to me, and I'm by myself in the middle of nowhere. So it wasn't like maybe I missed some blood that I should have, but I was having a hard time finding blood.
Yeah.
Eventually, by that grid search, wasn't finding anything that night. The next morning, came back in at daylight because I couldn't see anything anymore because of how dark it was that night. Came back in the next morning, searched and searched and searched, found a little blood, grid search, and I was devastated. I'm like, oh my God, you're not going to find this buck in here. I mean, it's just so thick, and I was unbelievably upset about it, so frustrated, and that's the situation. I said, all right, you're done hunting. Like, that deer is dead, and you have to find that deer, or you're going home with a punch tag. Like you're gonna. I've got five more days here until I have to go home, and I'm gonna walk every single hour of daylight.
Spend 5 days finding this deer,
and if I don't find that deer, then I'm done. So I don't know what the right thing for someone to do. I think that if I can understand if you know that you hit a deer in a way that is clearly not fatal. Like if you shoulder blade shot a deer and it gets 2 inches of penetration, or if you just graze a deer and there's a little bit of hair, but if there's some way you feel very, very clear that that is a non-lethal hit, and then you still did everything you possibly could do to make sure of that, in that situation, or especially if you see him again or get a picture again, in that situation, I can understand continuing to hunt in that kind of situation. And again, this is just me. This is the way I think through. I know there's different perspectives on this. I would say if you shoot a buck and it's a clearly lethal hit, I personally would have a really hard time now not punching that tag. Like, but that took a while for me to get to that point. Like that first year, I thought, well, because there's something that a thing you hear is you got to get back in the saddle. Like the only way to get over this is to start hunting again. And I understand that from like a how to make you feel better standpoint, like maybe. Yeah. But is that the right thing? I don't know. I mean, I don't know if there's a clear cut answer I don't know. But I think where my head's at now, for me to feel okay with what I'm doing, I would have punched that Montana tag.
Yeah, and it becomes that, right? Like we could have a wildlife manager come in here and tell us like, oh, we're, you know, as far as wound loss rates go, when we
take stuff into account.
Yeah, we take into account when we're doing the equation of population studies, we're taking into account the population of deer plus the population of hunters, and then we're putting wound loss rate in there somewhere in that equation. I'm sure that happens. And we'll endeavor to find someone that can give us some more information on that in future articles and podcasts and things that we do, but for sure that's happening. So given that, it becomes a personal thing then.
Yeah, from a larger macro management perspective, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah,
probably.
We're not saying like, wow, yes. Man, you know, as a hunter who's responsible for these things, like don't do this. No, that's not it. It's more like, and I think as a kid, you don't really have the caring for like the animal. You just don't have the capacity to have the caring and empathy, empathy for the animal as you do. When you've developed these relationships with these deer and you've tracked them and hunted them, you know, so I think I would also argue that whitetail hunters have the most empathy for the animals. People always talk shit, and I have in the past, about naming deer, but
you guys are always dogging on me.
Yeah, well, we'll continue to.
I know, that's all right.
One of the good things is that you develop empathy for that animal.
Yeah.
It's based on your relationship with it.
It's a very unique, weird kind of relationship.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, like one of the more complex relationships.
Very.
It's
the hunter's paradox is what I would.
Yeah,
call it.
Very much so. And there's a lot of folks that have written and philosophized, if that's a word, about these things. But you know, I'd like to put a point on it. I think it's a personal thing, but I think as a hunter, it's something to consider.
Yes,
like it's something to have in your like. Don't discount that scenario.
Yeah.
Don't say, I always, unless I get, like, I only tag it if I have the actual animal. Like,
yeah.
Leave yourself some room to make that choice when it's necessary.
Yeah.
You know, and don't write it off in any way. Like, keep it because it's useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely agree. And for me, it comes, a lot of people, you don't have to do this. A lot of people don't do this. But I think more and more, and definitely myself, the deeper I get into hunting, just the activity, participating in it, the more I think about it.
Yeah.
And the more I think about what I'm doing, the more I think about why am I doing it? Or how is this okay? Or how is what I'm doing, how do I justify this to myself? Those things are just in my mind a whole lot more. And it's those kinds of questions that lead me to the debates that we just had, having that own debate in my own head, and the decision I made this year versus what I made that 1 year. I think the more and more you think about these things, the more it will influence some of these decisions around all these tricky, hairy, complex topics.
Yeah, and I've been. We were talking last night. I'm not like a staunch opponent of the grip and grin, but I'm just like kind of over it.
Yeah.
And there's a million reasons why not to do it, I think. But I get why people do. If you look at my Instagram account, you'll see plenty of grip and grins mm-hmm. on there from years past. I haven't done one in a while, but I've done them recent enough that you could call me a hypocrite or a flip-flopper. And I'd have to defend that. But it's just keep evolving.
Yeah.
Keep thinking about the thing that we're doing. And like I said, I mean, whitetail hunting is it, man. It is the core of what we do. It is the most prevalent type of hunting. And it's the relationship with the animal we have the most as a society and a culture, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, we can talk about charismatic megafauna and our relationship there, but it's not as intense on a daily basis. I mean, I lived in Texas, deer lived in my backyard. Mm-hmm. I'm here in Montana, there was deer in my backyard last night. We went to the Meteor Christmas party and there were deer walking around all over the place.
Yep.
So our relationship with these animals is much more tangible than our relationship with others.
I think is the point that you're getting to with this, that we can clearly point to Wired to Hunt being the most important podcast.
Absolutely.
Because of that.
This is it.
Is this the Whitetail Podcast?
You better listen to that or you're a loser. And to close this all out, I got to tell a quick story here. We were in a meeting the other day, and my wife texted me. It's very intense, right? A couple of days worth of meetings. My wife texted me something around the like missing you. Well, of course, I miss her too.
Right.
And so I texted her back. What do you have it there? Did you pull it up?
Ben texted his quote unquote wife, "Busy meeting day, but can't wait for a weekend with my lovies. Are you okay?" And I responded, "Can't wait."
Text your buddy some sweet nothings that are meant for your lady.
Yeah, we got a good laugh out of that one.
We're going to have a good weekend, yes. You and I, this weekend.
I can't wait for it.
Because we are lovies.
We are lovies. I'm glad we established that early on.
Yeah.
It was good.
That's where we're going to end it. Right. Perfect. There. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, Ben.
That's it. That's all. Another episode of the Hunting Collective in the books. Thanks, Mark Kenyon. Great conversation. As a whitetail hunter, whitetail lover, it's good to hear his perspective on some of those different, more difficult topics, but just good to hang out with that guy. He's a good man. He's very caring in the way he approaches hunting and really enjoy talking to him. As always, what else is on the docket to talk about? Hey, there's a little thing online. There's a big controversy. Big controversy online this last week about stickers. I got, three negative comments. Basically, the whole internet was talking about the sticker gate. I call it sticker gate. Yeah, that's a good name for it. Posted about, hey, go to the meateater.com store, you know, there and buy some stickers. Well, apparently the sticker was $4, but the shipping was $6, making it a $10 sticker. That better be a damn good sticker for that much money. So that was something I didn't know. I didn't know about the shipping. So now that I know that, we'll try to get that changed. But in the meantime, there's more stuff there. So you could order, for example, a Pro Nuance anti-bullshit t-shirt. You could also order a kick-ass hoodie with the Hunting Collective podcast logo on there. And then you could also order a sticker. Right? Those three things are there right now. So if you go to store.themeateater.com or just go to themeateater.com, click on shop, you'll find those items there. You can buy them now, buy them in any quantity that you want, but I think we'll get over Stickergate, all three folks that complained. Hopefully you'll also go there and buy a shirt or a hoodie or something cool like that. It's fun to have put that stuff out there, so hope that you like it. And while you're there, if you have a little more time, click on the newsletter button up there. It says subscribe. You click on there. You put your email in. And then every Wednesday, the Meat Eater crew, which I'm a part of, sends you an email with all this awesome content in it. It's got Pat Durkin. It's got Brody Henderson, Steve Rinella, me. It's got Mark Kenyon, it's got April Vokey, it's got all kinds of stuff therein. So you're going to want to go and do that. That's going to be very important for everyone. So we thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for commenting. I really appreciate all the support we've had recently. All the downloads and the listens that we've been getting, that's been growing precipitously. And I'm thrilled about that. Never thought we'd be in a position we are today, but I'm happy about it. So thank you again for listening, and we'll see you next time on The Hunting Collective. Bye.
Hey, everybody knows Weber grills. I've been using Weber grills my whole life, and check it out. They got a pellet grill, the Weber Searwood Pellet Grill. Now, with a pellet grill, you can smoke, roast, and sear on the same grill. You can go from low and slow, okay, on smoke boost mode, or crank this thing all the way to a heat sear at 600 degrees. It's got a full great sear zone, so you can put more food on the flame. Get fired up for your new Weber Searwood Pellet Grill. Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today.